Did you know that you can be a critically thinking, rational person and be a Christian? Did you know that there's good evidence that Christianity is true? Did you know that the Christian faith can withstand the toughest of scrutiny? Welcome to the Cerebral Faith Podcast, where we believe because of the brains God gave us and not in spite of them. I'm your host, Evan Minton. Hello, and welcome to the Cerebral Faith Podcast, where we use the brains that God gave us. I'm going to be really candid here. I have been wounded on more than one occasion by my own brothers and sisters in Christ because of my view on creation. In the Answering Answers in Genesis Facebook group, I said that I posted once that there are some days I wish I had never touched theistic evolution material. I was an old earth creationist for many years, holding the day-age view of Genesis and the reasons to believe creation model, and those who identify as young earth creationists were very hostile towards me when I tried to discuss why I held that position. And let me tell you, the hostility I have faced as an old earth creationist, old earth with no evolution, pales in comparison to how much the vicious vitriol I've received since becoming an evolutionary creationist. It would be so much easier if I could just, as Yoda put it, unlearned what I have learned, so I could not be treated like a leper in so many Christian circles. Following the evidence where it leads can come at a great social cost. Unfortunately, this ongoing hostile behavior is creating a root of bitterness towards the young earth crowd that I'm constantly trying to pluck out and fight against. It's hard some days to just not like young earth creationists because of the sting of their disdain and scorn towards me for simply disagreeing with them on origins and how to interpret Genesis. It's really emotionally draining to continually be called a compromiser, heretic, man-pleaser, and at one point even Satan's messenger. And I am not alone. Many other old earth and evolutionary creationists have lamented over being treated like apostates over an issue that isn't one of the creedal essentials of Christianity. My guest today is Daniel Eaton, and he has written a book talking about the kind of damage that the evolution and creation controversy has been doing to those inside the faith, like me, and to those outside the faith, and how the church is ultimately hindering the gospel by waging war on itself and on science. The book is called The Creation Battle: Win, Lose, or Draw, How the Church is Fighting the Wrong Battles and Harming Herself in the Process. Hello, Mr. Eaton. It's glad to have you on the show. It's good to have you on the show, rather.
It's good to be here. I'm going to enjoy this.
So, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book.
Okay. Going back a little bit in time, very late 60s, early 70s, I had my first school project where you had to draw your family tree, and it was teaching a little bit about ancestry. It was probably linked to a science class or something. And in sitting down and drawing out my first family tree with my mother and my grandmother, who happened to be there at the time, I found out that she and her parents and her husband and his parents and their siblings were all raised in a flat earth church in Zion, Illinois. And that's where the Flat Earth Society was founded, and it was basically a fairly large cult outside of the Chicago area back in the very early part of the 20th century. So that got me interested in how can this be? In the late 60s, early 70s, Flat Earth was not as common as it is now. So this was like this odd thing in my family history that really interested me. And so I started studying biblical cosmology before I even understood what the word cosmology was. I got my first Scofield Reference Bible, you know, as a preteen. And it was my first grown-up Bible, you know. And so it had all the footnotes in there about the firmament. And, of course, it taught a gap theory view of Genesis, which thing about But that got me started into the study of when did, you know, why did people believe what they believed? And even though I was growing up in a church that was very independent fundamentalist Baptist church that taught young earth, I didn't really see it as a big doctrinal issue. It wasn't really, at that time, it wasn't really part of the culture war that it became. And maybe we can talk about that a little bit later. But I grew up believing in a young earth, accepting a young earth, because I got a lot more of that at church than I did just in reading the footnotes in my Scofield Bible. And was a young earth creationist until I heard a local Christian apologist here in the Atlanta area interview Hugh Ross on a radio show, look on a local Christian channel. And that was the first time I ever came across the idea that there were Christians out there that didn't believe in a young earth. And, you know, my jaw hung open as I was driving home listening to this. You know, who is this heretic? You know, where's he getting this idea? And so I immediately went out and found a copy of his book. And I think it was Creation and Time. It was very early 90s. So I got it and I read it and it just kind of blew my mind. And then I started like fact checking him and some of the things that he was saying, and realized that a lot of the things that I had been taught about church history, as far as the insinuation that the church and the early church fathers have always taught young earth creationism, or creation science as it was called at the time, I found out that that wasn't true. And that caused a real crisis in faith. And I realized I could not trust everything that came from the pulpit. I had to go and build my faith on a firm foundation of what the Bible says, not what some preacher says. And it was a good experience to go through. I think everybody at some point needs to look at the basis of their faith, kind of tear it down and rebuild it on solid arguments, historical facts, and what the Bible actually says, as opposed to the editorial comments of others. But that got me into a long study in different views of creation, because once I found out that Hugh Ross and Reasons to Believe had a view, then I started finding out that there were still people out there promoting a day-age view, the gap theory, appearance of age, all kinds of things. And I ended up studying close to 24 different views of creation. And a lot of people look at that as a waste of time, but it really did something mental inside my brain, because I had studied so many different views of the passage. I no longer interpreted Genesis 1, Genesis 2, and 3 through the rose-colored lens of a specific interpretation. I no longer read it or read into it what I had been told that it had, that it was saying. And so it allowed me to really approach the text with fresh eyes and study it without a lot of the quote-unquote assistance or insistence maybe, of these creationist organizations out there that tell you that it has to mean a particular thing.
Yeah, I've definitely gone through several visions on my view of creation as well. I was in the, as I said in the introduction, I was in the Day Age, Hugh Ross, Reason to Believe camp for several, many, many years. And then I started looking at BioLogos' website, their blogs, and their materials. And I was like, the Bible and evolution are not really that incompatible after all. At first, I was convinced, concordism, that's just not a... That's a bad hermeneutical framework from the outset. But then I was like, okay, now there's more than one non-concordist interpretation. So now I have to, now that I've abandoned that entire framework, I have to find a new view. So I looked at the framework hypothesis. Right. I looked at the Proclamation Day view. Eventually, I came to embrace John Walton's Cosmic Temple Inauguration view, or the functional origins view. After looking very deeply at all the different non-concordist views, but I could change my mind on that someday if presented with new information. I'm confident in where I've landed, but I'm not dogmatic about it.
Right.
Now, in the first chapter of your book, you discuss worldviews and presuppositions and how this can hinder both our search for truth and our conversations about our beliefs with others. Unpack the content of that chapter for us.
Okay. I mentioned rose-colored glasses earlier. We all approach anything that we read within a certain framework of what we believe is real, what we believe is not real, what we believe is true, what is not true. I may have used this example in my book, but when a magician pulls a rabbit out of a hat, we understand that as something that's not normal because that doesn't fit within our framework, of what we have seen around us and what we know to be real. And so we recognize that as something abnormal or special. And the same thing happens whenever we listen to any kind of new idea. We filter that through our framework of what we know to be true. And it's also kind of processed in the context of how we think. And here in the West, we tend to think very logically, very scientifically. We tend to see the text of Genesis as a outline of proof texts of, against evolution or against an old earth or whatever. Because those are our challenges that we're facing today. Those are the cultural hot button topics that we're exposed to, and so we go to the passages like in Genesis, and we approach it almost like you would a grocery list or a recipe that has a list of ingredients, and we're not approaching it as something that is deep theology and poetic and has mystery behind it. In the Eastern mindset, they believe that the best way to learn something is to study a text and come to realize what the text is telling us, to discover a truth in the text. Whereas here in the West, we approach it like a list of bullet points. Tell me what the text says, outline it for me. Okay, this is what and I'm going to memorize this list. And they don't do it that way. That's why you see all through Scripture, you see this constant encouragement to meditate on the text. Because when you meditate on it, and when you approach it objectively with an open mind of that it might be saying something different from what I've been taught, or something in addition to what I've been taught, you discover truths in the text. And those stick with you much more than something that you've heard that the text says. It's almost like the analogy of do what I do, or do what I say, not what I do, because actions speak louder than words, and we tend to pick up on the actions and the attitudes of our parents and mimic those much more than we would them telling us, you know, if they're a chain smoker and they tell us not to smoke, their habit is going to be teaching us a whole lot more than their words. And we're likely to pick up, you know, cigarettes and stuff because that's what we see. And that's the same way it is kind of between this Eastern and Western mindset where they believe that the more that you studied it and the more you discovered nuggets of truth in it or insights from it, that those things will impact your brain and you'll remember them a lot more than our Western way of learning. So we kind of need to approach the text realizing our worldview and realizing the helpful quote-unquote glasses that we wear of what the text says. And that is particularly hard in this particular topic because you have creationist organizations out there that are actively teaching and putting out memes and cartoons and everything that say you're supposed to, you know, interpret the world through the glasses or the lens of Scripture. And by that, they're not meaning Genesis 1. They're meaning what they're telling you that Genesis 1 has to mean. You know, so they are encouraging filtering outside information through a lens that doesn't admit that we see through a lens darkly, you know, as the Bible says. And so we need to be objective and realize those lenses that we have, those filters that we have. And it's difficult to recognize in the mirror. We'll see it when somebody else is biased and not objective and not seeing, you know, everything, you know, be real skeptical of certain ideas and real accepting of others based on who said it or whatever. I mean, you see that on Facebook all the time. But we need to be equally skeptical of the things that we hear that we like and equally open to the things that we hear that we may not agree with. And in order to, you know, be objective in a search for truth.
Yeah, I agree. I definitely agree with that. And I know this even in my own investigation in the topic of Genesis. Like, for such a long time, I only phrased the debate as a dichotomy. Young Earth creationism, the Ken Ham camp, and Old Earth creationism, the Hugh Ross camp. Evolution, no, that's liberalism. That's heretical. I'm not even going to consider that. But God convicted me about, you know, around 2016. I really felt this really heavy pulling on my heart saying, you know, you ought to give the evolutionary creationists a fair hearing. And so that's when I started looking at BioLogos articles and their books and started reading John Walton and Peter Enns and Deborah Harzma. And just one after one after one, my theological objections to evolutionary creationism just started falling. And then I thought, okay, well, I no longer am theologically opposed to evolution. Maybe I ought to I looked at the evidence for evolution, but as I saw it as like an argument for atheism. So I'm like, okay, now maybe I ought to since I'm looking at the scientific evidence with new eyes, maybe I'll come out with a different conclusion. And turns out I did. I think Aaron Yilmaz, in his book, Deliver Us from Evolution, he's a biologist and he's a Christian. I think he gives the most powerful scientific case for evolution I've ever come across.
Yeah, that idea that we should approach it with, you know, objectively and give them an honest hearing comes right out of one of my favorite Bible passages. Proverbs 18:17, the first to present his case seems right until another comes to examine him. And I kind of try to approach this or encourage people to approach this like you would if you were an objective juror. You don't make up your mind based on what the prosecution says and based on what the prosecution, how the prosecution may frame the defense's argument. You wait and you let both sides present their own case, because the prosecution isn't going to give you the strongest arguments from the defense. He's going to make, you know, point out the weak arguments, the straw man, things that may not even be true, and even probably, let's see, 15, 18 years ago, something like that, I did a 7-hour lecture series on this topic to homeschool parents, and I was giving them global flood and local flood arguments and young earth and old earth arguments and why people believed both. And at the time, I didn't even cover evolution or theistic evolution, because I had so many caricature understandings and straw men, basically descriptions of what evolution taught. I was so ignorant about what evolution taught that I just dismissed it and wrote it off, just kind of waved my hands like, and we're not even going to talk about that because everybody knows that's wrong, kind of thing. And I didn't give it a fair hearing in the lecture that I did, and I probably, that's one of my big regrets. I should have done that. I lost a big opportunity to do that, and I felt really bad later when I realized that some of the reasons that I had dismissed theistic evolution and thought that my theistic evolution friends were just heretics was based on my own misunderstandings. And I see that in a lot of Facebook groups that, you know, I'll drop in on occasionally, and some of the things that they will say, like, some of them believe that an alligator can give birth to a bird, and that's what macroevolution is, or whatever. And I've actually seen that in print as an example of, well, nobody sees this kind of thing happen. Well, yeah, evolution doesn't claim that those kind of things happen. So I didn't give it a fair shot, and that was because of these glasses that I was wearing that were actually blinders in many ways. And the young earth organizations aren't going to give the other positions in their best possible light. They're going to present evidences that are arguments that they may have arguments against, but they're not going to be open or objective to it. And that's one of the good things that you see from people who eventually leave the young earth camp, is because you can see things like Reasons to Believe and BioLogos getting together and having joint sessions at apologetic conferences. You will see them, the presidents of those organizations inviting Ken Ham for a dinner where the three of them can sit down and show that, yes, we can have Christian fellowship together, even though we disagree. I'm not a theistic evolutionist, but you and I can have a perfectly rational conversation, an objective conversation. We can focus on where we agree, and where we don't agree, we can still be in fellowship. And that is a really, really big benefit of getting outside of it's almost a cultic mentality. I've taught on cults and world religions in the past, and there's almost a cultic aspect to young earth creationism, where you're not allowed to question anybody, you're not allowed to disagree with the powers that be, there are no real, the head people don't really answer to anybody else. There's a lot of different aspects to how that's set up that is very similar to how cults are set up. And it goes all the way down to not associating with people that disagree with young earth creationism, and basically blackballing them or expelling them, excommunicating them from your fellowship, that kind of stuff. I actually had somebody tell my wife one time that she should divorce me and she and the kids leave because they found out that I was not a young earth creationist. And this was coming from somebody that was a young earth creationist. They thought that my influence was so bad that my wife and kids would be better off without me. And it's like, what? Yeah. How extreme can you get? But, and I've seen this in even in young earth schools where if you pose too many questions that they don't have a ready answer to, and you show that you're skeptical of some of the arguments, that you get blackballed. You get, you know, my son had that happen to him. He had teachers tell his friends that they should stop hanging around with him because he was a bad influence, because he was, you know, posing some hard questions, and they didn't have the answers. So, you know, just shunned the people that, you know, that might rock the boat kind of mentality. And that's really sad.
Yeah, that's just terrible and shocking. At the beginning of chapter 2, you wrote, and you kind of alluded to this near the beginning, about cosmology. You wrote, and I'm quoting from your book here, "The clash over creation interpretations in our culture is largely one of worldviews. Not only do we have the Christian atheist thing going on and the ratcheting up of the rhetoric and the creationist compromisers conflict, but there is a key worldview conflict at the core of this battle. I'm talking about the clash between the ancient worldview of cosmology and our current worldview of cosmology. I have tried to illustrate that on the cover of this book with a contrast between an ancient view and a modern photo of space. They saw the stars as inside their bubble. Our view doesn't even have a bubble. The ancient view of cosmology will never agree with what we know now. As such, a religious cosmology based on that ancient description is never going to match up with what science tells us of the actual cosmology," end quote. Now, I've looked into this, and this is one of the this is why I rejected Concordism and why I started looking into John Walton's, you know, the Cosmic Temple view and the Framework Hypothesis and the Proclamation Day view. It's just that, you know, when you look at the Bible in its ancient Near Eastern context and you read it through their lenses, which is what any hermeneutics teacher will tell you, you know, I notice a lot of inconsistency among theologians. They'll say, interpret the Bible in its cultural context. Well, I mean, except for when you get to Genesis 1. but, right. Yeah, explain to our audience how the biblical authors understood cosmology, or as John Walton calls it, he calls it cosmic geography, the shape of the world, right, and how it worked.
Right. I actually had an episode of this on my own podcast. I'll give a plug there. It's called Creation and Conflict, and you can find it everywhere. I'm new to this. I'm only 5 or 6 episodes in, but I actually interviewed Brian Godawa last episode, and we spent an hour to an hour and a half discussing this topic. But basically, the cosmology of the ancient Hebrews and the ancient Babylonians, Sumerians, all of those people in the ancient Near East was very, very logic driven. It wasn't scientific like ours is. We have the benefit of sending telescopes into space and looking back on the Earth to see what it looks like and that kind of stuff. They didn't have that. So when they looked up, they saw something blue and water came down occasionally. So that must be water up there, but something must be holding it back because it doesn't always come down. So they had this belief that was fairly common. There were differences between the different cultures, but if you go and you look at ancient cosmology, they had this belief that there was this dome over us, and this dome held back the oceans of the heavens, or, you know, some body of water up there, and the gods be controlling everything from above us so that they can see us. So they must be up there above that somewhere. And this moon covered basically a circular flat earth. And you see these references all through the Bible. And there's an excellent resource that I'll plug here on his behalf. But if you go to briangodawa.com, you can download his first book in his Chronicles of the Nephilim series. It's called Noah Primeval. And he has an appendix at the end of that book that is 30 or 40 pages of all of the references in the Bible that talk about this cosmology that doesn't really exist. About the earth having edges and the earth not moving and sitting on pillars and on foundations and being encircled by the sea and this firmament, this hard dome over us with water above it. And it's a three-tiered cosmology in that you have a location in heaven above where things exist, spiritual beings, and then you have Earth itself, Earth not being a planet, Earth being the dry ground that is surrounded by water. And then under that you have an underworld or Hades where spirits and the dead go. And even under that or incorporated into it, you have a body of water called the Deep that not only does it represent chaos, but you also have sea monsters, multi-headed, fire-breathing sea monsters that inhabit this body of water. That body of water doesn't exist. These creatures don't exist. But it is all part of the cultural concept of how the universe is laid out. Their universe being something totally different than ours. So when we use the Bible where it talks about how things are, or why things came to be and who caused these things to be, God is basically using accommodation to tell them that I'm bigger than the monsters in the deep that you think of as being powerful and causing chaos or whatever. It starts out with that in the very, very beginning of Genesis, in Genesis 1-2, where it talks about the Spirit hovering over those waters. It shows a sovereignty over chaos. And it's not teaching, when you realize that the physical aspects, or much of the physical aspects of the creation that we see in Genesis 1 are not really what we understand them to be, then we can't really use Genesis 1 to be telling us about when our view of creation came to be. It's teaching something else. And when you compare the common features of that worldview of these three tiers and God's being above it and all that stuff, when you compare what Genesis 1 is saying versus what the surrounding cultures believed and remove those common elements of this three-tiered cosmology, what you see being explained is the new revelation that is not material ontology about when did specific objects come to be, but it's more metaphysical or teleological. It's the purpose behind these things and who is sovereign over these things, who controls these things. It's theology, not biology or, you know, history. It's theology more than anything else. And we miss that when we approach it trying to make it a proof text in some, you know, evolution debate or young earth, old earth debate.
Yeah, I like to phrase it this way. I like to say that Genesis 1 is answering the question, why did God create everything, rather than how did God create everything? Yeah. So when you look at like day 4, it says God created the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night, and to mark and signs for seasons, yeah, days, and you. It's not, they don't care about how it came into being physically, it's like, why is it there? Why did God make it?
Yeah, when you think about this, when you go back and you look at, for example, the Greek and the Roman legends about their pantheon of gods, the date of when those things came to be is irrelevant. I mean, that's not part of their stories. And what they're materially made of is not really a major part of their story. The major part of their story is the conflict, the actions of the gods, the results of the actions of the gods, and it's more of the result of the things that the gods do that is the main point of the story. And even though the ancient Hebrews didn't have a pantheon of gods the way surrounding cultures might have, their view of the world included a lot more spiritual beings than what we typically think of today. I'm not talking about Frank Peretti with a demon behind every action or something, but they were much more in tune with the idea of there being a divine council and God being amongst the gods and a lot of that. And I'm going to have Brian Godawa back late, you know, for another episode, and we're going to get into that a lot more when I get into Genesis 6 in my podcast, and just who are these sons of God, and who is this divine council. I'm actually in the future, I'm going to be having Mike Heiser on.
Yeah, I had him on. I had him on last week, and we talked all about this divine council stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's really fascinating. You don't hear this in church. You got to go to Brian Godawa or Michael Heiser, or you got to go to the scholarly material, because your pastor's just not. If he preaches on a text that talks about the divine council, he's either going to go to some implausible interpretation, like, oh, these are about Jewish judges, Psalm 82, or he's just going to skip over it because this is just too weird. I don't understand it.
Yeah, the sad thing is that where our culture is now, and I kind of put this in my notes to kind of get into it in a little bit later, but where our culture is right now, we don't tend to learn new things at church. We tend to have current beliefs reinforced in church. And so we tend to not grow in spiritual maturity when it comes to learning new things that you don't normally get at the pastoral level, but you would get at the academic level or the scholarly level of theology, where people like Dr. Heiser has spent, you know, a lifetime researching these topics and pulling in, you know, all this information, not just from the Bible and these unknown passages of the Bible, because everybody just skips over them because they don't know what to do with them. But pulling that information together and actually producing a work that can explain new things to us. And people are afraid of the new things. And I think pastors are afraid of losing congregants if they start talking about some of this stuff. So they just avoid it, and they just, you know, they'll have Ken Ham in again to do another creation sermon or something. And so, you know, people aren't really, they're not open to learning the new stuff. They're more interested in being right and having their current views reinforced, because confirmation bias is a lot easier than cognitive dissonance. You know?
Yeah. So, in your book, you talk about James Usher. Tell us a little bit about him.
Okay. James Usher lived back.
He's not a rapper, by the way. Don't confuse him with the rapper Usher.
Right, right. James Usher was an archbishop in Ireland. And he was writing a book back in the middle 1600s called The Annals of the World. It was originally written in Latin and then translated into English. But he wanted to write a definitive history of the world from creation all the way up to the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. And so he gathered information from a lot of places. A lot of sources and source material no longer exist, so there's no real way to double check a lot of his stuff. But he started using historical references going all the way back to the time of Nebuchadnezzar, and then picking up some astronomical stuff as well as genealogies in the Bible to come up with the most accurate date he could for creation. And he was doing this at the same time that John Lightfoot, who is the vice chancellor of Cambridge University, was coming up with his own dates. So the two of them were kind of going back and forth and debating, you know, which methodology should be used, because they were coming up with different dates. And ultimately, Usher came up with a date. And I actually have this as a quote. He said, "I deduced that the time from the creation until midnight, January 1 of 1 AD, was 4,003 years, 73 days, and 6 hours." What? So he basically dated creation to 6 p.m. on August 23rd, 4004 BC. And we look at that and we just kind of laugh. It's ridiculous that you would think that, given the vague nature of so much of the information that we have, that you can get to that precise of a date from it. But his goal was to see what kind of precise date that he could come up with. I'm not sure if he actually believed that that is the specific date and time, but his goal was to come up with a precise date. And the problem is that when that got published, a lot of scholars started accepting it as the best work at the time when it came to the history of the world. And some of the early publications of the King James Bible actually picked up that date and put that date in footnotes or little side notes in Genesis 1. And so people believed that this date was something that was derived from the Bible, because, of course, this Annals of History was, you know, started at creation and went all the way through the fall of Jerusalem. It must be a religious work. It came from an Anglican archbishop. And they didn't really realize that most of the material that was used to come up with a lot of this information wasn't from the Bible. About 85% of it wasn't from the Bible. It was from other things. And even when it came to the things that he took from Scripture, the genealogies, for example, you have to decide which one of the multiple genealogies we have is the accurate one. You have to decide which of, you know, are the dates in the Septuagint the accurate, or the ages for the patriarchs in the Septuagint, are they the accurate ages? That's probably what, you know, Christ grew up learning. Or is it from the Hebrew text? You know, because depending on which text you grab, the ages are different. And even when you get all back to Genesis 1, you can't date creation without making major assumptions, like you have to assume that chapter 2 took place on day 6. You choose that the days are consecutive, that the days are 24 hours. I mean, there's a whole list of assumptions there. And if any one of those assumptions are incorrect, then we can't date creation based on Genesis 1. I have no problem with coming up with, you know, a date of 4004 BC for a guy named Adam. But to jump from Adam to there being a creative event for the universe in Genesis 1:1, you can't get there without a bunch of assumptions. And I don't think anybody has enough information to be dogmatic about these particular assumptions. There are very good reasons, for example, to think that the days may not have been consecutive or may not have been 24 hours. But actually, I think they're 12 hours. But, you know, there is a lot of reason for debate on those things. So I don't think we can be dogmatic to reach, you know, that level of precision when it comes to dating Genesis 1:1.
Could you repeat a little bit of that last part? Because you kind of broke up. I'm getting on my Skype screen here. It says poor internet connection. Just that last part about the assumptions.
Yeah, we can't get from a birth date for Adam to a date for Genesis 1:1 without making some assumptions, or if you would rather call them deductions, from the text. For example, we have to assume the length of the days. Are they 24-hour days or not? We have to assume whether they're consecutive or not. We have to assume whether or not there's a gap, as some propose, between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, the gap theory. We have to assume that Adam was created on day 6. The text doesn't say that. We have to assume he's part of the mankind that was talked about on day 6. We have to assume that it's even talking about material ontology, for example. Our view, not necessarily their view. There's about a dozen assumptions there. A very big one being we have to make a deduction or assumption as to whether or not Genesis 1:1 is a creative act, or whether it is describing conditions prior to God saying, let there be light. If it's not a creative act, then we don't know the date of all of the things, you know, that were separated from days 1 through 3. We even have to assume that day 1 is the first day, and the text doesn't say it's the first day. In the text, it refers to it as day 1. So it's day 1 of creation, or day 1 of this story, but it doesn't say it's the first day of time.
Yeah, it could be the first day of God decreeing functions and inaugurating his temple, not the first day of the universe, for example.
Right.
So, let's talk about what kind of, you know, we already talked about, you know, some of the damage, some of the divisions and strife that this whole debate has caused in the church, but what other kinds of damage has this caused inside the church and even outside the church? I know I hear a lot about the young earth or bust philosophy, how that has led many to just say, you know what I'm seeing, what I'm learning in college from science, astrophysics, biology, paleontology, and what my pastor's telling me, they both can't be right, and the evidence for an old earth and an old universe, that seems pretty compelling, so I guess I can't be a Christian anymore.
Right. And that's part of it, because the young earth organizations in particular, and I don't want to beat up on them, but you can't really talk about this without discussing the big elephant in the room, which is their take on this. They present everything as their view is the Christian view. They've relabeled scientific creationism as biblical creationism because a lot of those scientific arguments they were using turned out not to be true. So they've kind of rebranded it as biblical creationism now. So their view is, quote unquote, the biblical or Christian view of origins. And they contrast it with the atheist view. The interesting thing is both the young earth creationist and the atheist read Genesis 1 the exact same way. And so the irony there is just wild. But they don't see, they see, they'll say that it's possible to be a Christian and not be a young earth creationist. But they will say it in the context of, these people don't really believe the Bible. These people don't really have a good faith. They may not even have a saving faith. It's possible. They'll say it in the context that you'll see many Protestants say, it's possible to be Catholic and be a Christian. But, you know, it's the same kind of idea that you're either towing the line of young earth creationism, or you're an atheist, or someone that compromises with them. And they will judge you based on that. They will assume that you don't believe in the Bible, or you're not a Christian unless you're a young earth creationist. And you'll see this, I discussed this in one of the episodes of my podcast. You'll see this often in the way they defend young earth creationism. When you point out, for example, that only maybe 3 or 4% of the world believes in young earth creationism, they'll immediately respond with the passage about, well, narrow is the way that leads to salvation, you know, whatever. They'll pull out these verses that talk about how few people are actually saved, or the persecution that true Christians face, or whatever. All these things that are proof text or in the context of salvation itself as a proof text that they're the saved one because of what they believe, and everybody else is something else. You're backslidden at best, and heretic at worst. You know, I'm sure you've been labeled as many things as I have over the years.
I wrote a whole article about this called the two-faced nature of the young earth creationist. You know, that I'll be in this very heated, hostile conversation where this person's calling me a compromiser, a heretic, a man-pleaser, and a blasphemer, and at the end of the conversation, he'll say, I'm praying for you, brother.
Right.
It's like, you just called me all of these horrible names that you would call an apostate, and you call me brother, and you say you're praying. Are you kidding me? It's like...
One of my favorites is
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Child of the... How is that even possible? How can you be a fold child of, you know, at that point you realize that's just making sense. But it's that gets back to what I referred to about some of the cultic tendencies, in that you can see anybody out there, anybody that doesn't hold their particular view, being treated, you know, the worst thing possible, and being forced to
ridiculed, rampaged. You're really breaking up. You're breaking up really badly now. Can you repeat that?
Yeah, but what you'll see is in the young earth camp, the treatment of people that are outside that camp, with ridicule and mocking, outright lies about not only what they believe, but they believe it. And it's a way of demonizing the opposition. Once you label some group and label some person, you can dismiss what they say and not give it a fair hearing because, oh, well, they're this type of person. You see that all the time with the way the race card is played in politics. Once you label as a don't take anything you say seriously. And you see that in the way old earth creationists and holistic evolutionists are treated. And when I bring this up, they'll say, well, you don't know all the things that the atheists have called me. And maybe I, but I don't expect the atheists to act like Christ. And if you're claiming that you're a Christian and you're claiming to represent him, then you're held to a higher standard. And it doesn't matter what the atheist does. It matters what you do.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that a lot too. When I call out this group of people on their bad behavior, I get the whole tutuque fallacy. It's like, well, evolutionary creation, theistic evolutionists and old earth creationists have treated me badly too. And I'm like, well, you know, if that's true, then it was bad for them to do that too. We need to, you know, it's bad for anybody to do it, but it's, you know, recognize that, you know, your own camp, it, you know, you may not be this way. And I know I know several young earth creationists who are, you know, they don't treat this as, you know, they don't act like, they don't slander me. They don't slander old earthers. They can debate this with gentleness and respect, but you know, you still have to realize that there's a lot of people in your camp that are not behaving the way that they're supposed to. And when you get so many from other groups saying you guys are acting like a bunch of asses, you know, maybe that ought to tell you something.
Well, that goes back a little bit to what I had said about following the example of your parents. When you have things like Ken Ham being disinvited from homeschool conferences because of public comments that he's made about other speakers there, in this case Peter Enns, that had eating curriculum, you know, that taught evolutionary creationism. He said some pretty nasty things about Peter Enns in the homeschool conference and got disinvited from future conferences by the young earth leaders of that conference because of the fact that the way he treated somebody that disagreed with him was not very Christ-like. I've actually, when my daughter graduated from her high school, it was a homeschool group that she went to, and they were very, very strict young earth. And one of the leading people, one of the well-known names from Answers in Genesis, came to give the commencement of it, and he referred to the faith of Peter Enns, in air quotes, in front of everybody, basically telling them with her actions that he didn't really have true faith. She even made a comment, well, gave it away, but even made the comment that Peter Enns probably denied the virgin birth as well. Denied young earth creationism. As if creationism is now elevated to that level, it is now a creed of Christianity. And if you don't believe in young creationism, then you probably doubt everything else that's in the Nicene Creed or Apostles' Creed.
You kind of broke up there, but I kind of got what you said. You said there was a speaker from Answers in Genesis there, and he used Peter Enns' faith in air quotes, and basically right. Implied that he wasn't a Christian. Now look, I disagree with a lot of things that Peter Enns said. I mean, I was appalled when I read Evolution of Adam and he was defending the documentary hypothesis. But I'm not going to go so far as to doubt his salvation. I don't think, you know, I think he's got some things wrong, but I don't view him as you know, like a Bart Ehrman type. I think to do that is wrong. I can disagree with him, and I wrote a response to one of his articles where he you know, said, you know, he had a lot of complaints about the practice of Christian apologetics. But, you know, hey, I disagree with him respectfully, and I think we should all do that with each other.
But if we were to label him as a bleeding heart liberal who compromises with atheists, then we may not pick on things that he has presented, like the incarnate model of inspiration, where he talked about Christ being both God and man, and the Bible being both a product of God and man. And I thought that was a very helpful analogy. But label people like that and then just dismiss anything that they say because you disagree with them in one particular area, then you basically are reinforcing this echo chamber mentality that we have today, where you don't learn anything new because you don't listen to anybody that doesn't already believe everything you do.
Yeah, and that's what this is what I say. You know, I have several of R.C. Sproul's DVDs, his teachings, and some of his books, and you know, I have one of my Arminian friends, Maybe it was Timothy Keller she said this about. I can't remember if it was Sproul or Keller. And she basically asked me, you know, why are you reading Sproul? Don't you know that he's a Calvinist? And I'm like, yeah, and I think he's wrong in that area. But I mean, for one thing, I can't shut out my ears to what Calvinists say even about Calvinism, but for another thing, he says a lot of good things about a lot of other stuff, and I agree with him on these things. And you know, I loved his From Dust to Glory course. It was like 57 video lectures, and his Last Days According to Jesus is a very good work on partial preterism. And so, you know, I kind of cringe at some of the stuff he says about Calvinism, but I can't live in an echo chamber for one thing, but
right.
For another thing, you know, if you're going to turn someone away because you disagree with him on one point, you know, he may be saying a lot of stuff that you do like and you might benefit from, but you're not listening to him because, you know, you rejected him because of all this other stuff. This is what I think about people who, they don't read William Lane Craig, they don't read Lee Strobel or Frank Turek because they're old earthers. And I'm like, you're really missing out on a lot of the great apologetic material that Craig and Strobel and Turek are putting out there, and you're just not getting into their stuff because they take a different view of Genesis? That's just...
Part of that comes from the worldview filter of thinking that everybody through church history has agreed with me on my particular view of creation, when that hasn't been the case. So many of the doctrines of the church, we understand them today, were or initially articulated by early church fathers that were not what we would consider biblical creation. They may not have believed in the literal days, for example, or they may have taken a very symbolic view of Genesis 1. And if we understood the topic more from a historical perspective and saw that we have obtained core doctrines of the church through the help of people that we currently disagree with on some other topic, I think we'd be a lot more open in listening to some of the best theologians and philosophers we have in the church today that we might disagree with on a particular topic.
Yeah, amen. And so, folks, the book is called The Creation... It's The Creation Conflict, right?
Not The Creation
Debate. The Creation and Conflict is the podcast.
Okay,
the Creation Battle.
Okay.
Is the name of the book.
Okay. Okay. I got the podcast and the book name confused. It's the Creation Battle: Win, Lose, or Draw by Daniel Eaton. It's available on paperback too, isn't it, or is it just Kindle?
No, it's just Kindle. And actually, I wanted to mention something to you. I know you're trying to your patron so that you can to a new blog host, I am going to send you a PDF copy of the book that you can distribute to any of your Patreon supporters.
Can you repeat that? You got to kind of cut out. I think you said you're going to send me a PDF of the book that I can distribute to Cerebral Faith patrons.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
If somebody is one of your patrons, I'm going to give you a PDF version. You can distribute.
Okay. So you hear that, folks?
Or I can send it to you in an EPUB format, so that maybe that'll help drive up some donation to your ministry
you.
Here.
You hear that, folks? You're in for a treat. You're gonna get if you're a Cerebral Faith patron, you're gonna get this book for free. Or if you're not a patron and you just want to buy it, I'm gonna have the link to it in the show notes. So if you're listening to it on Stitcher or Podbean or Anchor, be sure to scroll down the episode's description and you'll be able to buy it there. But you can get it. You can get it in a PDF if you're a patron. Not only that, but you get early access to my blog posts, to my podcast. You get shout outs on the podcast, like Jordan Apodaca and Kevin Walker and James Whitaker and Austin Long. So you get a lot of other cool stuff too if you become a patron. So thank you, Daniel, for coming on the show. Thank you for talking about this very important topic. And thank you, listeners, for following the Cerebral Faith podcast. This is going to be the last interview I'm going to do for a while. The next few episodes are just going to be monologue episodes. I'm actually going to be talking about Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 for the next maybe 3, 4, or 5 episodes, and then I'm probably going to have another interview. So thank you for listening. Peace out, and God bless. We'll be right back.